supervisor for Ulysses Town Court, the Honorable Betty Poole, who is the Enfield Town Justice.
I'm Ray Slaughter, and this is Mark Solomon. We're both attorneys here in town. And then to Mark's left is the Honorable Glenn Galbraith, who is Cayuga Heights Village Justice. And then to Justice Galbraith's left is the Honorable Scott Miller, who is the Ithaca City Court Judge. We have other guests here in the audience. There's Joe Mariana, who is the administrator and the chief of the legislature. I'm not going to give me a promotion, but it's something like that. And we also have others here as well. So first, we have the agenda, and we also have the review of the agenda. Are there any changes or modifications to the agenda? Any additions? All right. The agenda as proposed stands. Approval of the October 28th, 15 minutes. Those were circulated, I think, yesterday, maybe the day before. Do we have any comments or suggested changes or motion? Mark moves. Do we have a second?
Second.
Betty seconds. Any further comment? All those in favor, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
If there are any typos or anything, as we've done before, just get those to Joe, and he'll correct them before he posts them, okay? Public comment. We do have a period of time for anybody from the public who can speak for a few minutes if they have anything that they would like to add to the conversation before we get into the formal presentations. And I do not have any public comment, so that's taken care of. Chair's report. I am pleased to advise that we have, as I mentioned the last time, we had three individuals who were interested in working for us from the law school. And one of them, we've already given him the assignment that we discussed at the last meeting. There were a couple of questions, legal questions that we wanted him to research. He's the fellow who's going to be heading to Colorado in January, and therefore, but he has promised that he could give us 30 to 40 hours of time to do some legal research on the issues that we were discussing at the last meeting. So he's on board. And then the other two individuals, and unfortunately I don't have their names right in front of me, but they're two law students. They were not able to make it here this evening, but they are definitely both positively enthusiastic about getting involved, and they will be involved, and we will start giving them some tasks for data collection and research probably by the next meeting. So. Yes, Gwen.
Question. I saw in the minutes, I think, of the last meeting that we were going to maybe talk about what we're going to have them do. Has that been decided, what the other two students are going to do?
It is. The first individual is researching.
No, I know the first individual.
Okay.
It's the other two.
The other two, we have not given them specific tasks. However, there are some areas of data collection and collation that we think ought to be examined. In other words, we've been getting information, both anecdotally and data-wise, from many of our speakers, as well as in some of the reports that we've been getting from the state. And now I think Joe's going to tell us a little bit about the youth court issue. And so I think we need to give some direction to these students as to what we would like them to do. And I was hoping, depending on how far we go this evening, we may be able to have a further discussion about that.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Gwen. All right. Joe.
Thanks, Ray. With respect to youth court information, Ray and others talked about youth court in Ontario County at the last meeting. And we said we would try to pull together some information not only on what was being done in Ontario County, but more generally what's happening with youth courts. And I think I sent some information pretty quickly after the meeting about Ontario, but then over the course of the last week or so, we've also compiled additional information about youth courts, which Gwen is sending down the line. The first is kind of a collection of things that we found on web pages about specific youth court arrangements in other places, including Onondaga County, New York City, an association of youth courts that gives some background and context about youth courts in New York State. And then also we found an interesting article of the, I think it's the Bar Association Journal from back in 2011, that was devoted to youth courts. And there's a series of pretty good articles in there about youth courts. So that's the second piece that you have. It's kind of a standalone that captures most of the articles on that. So that's just to you for background and context. So if anything grows out of that with additional information collection, just let me know. I also will advise the group that we are trying to post the audio transcripts within a day or two of the meetings, which we think is pretty good form. I'm just leaving things here with the legislative staff, and they've been really good about getting it posted on your webpage very quickly after the event. So if you hear folks who want to learn about what happened, you can quickly refer them to the webpage and they can listen in.
All right. Thanks, Joe. Fair enough. So we are now at the point where we would love to hear and examine both Ms. Diedrich and Dr. Brown. Both individuals have great depth in their respective fields and would like to add some comments, but I think more importantly would like to engage in a conversation on some of the issues that are important to our inquiry. So without further ado, why don't we start with Deputy Duke, please.
Thanks, first of all, for having me. And I wanted to acknowledge just briefly those elected magistrates and judges and thank them for their public service. I know that it's pretty rotten pay, especially in the townships, and a lot of aggravation. And as a former elected official, I can say I can commiserate with many of you on the demands of the job. I'm not here, the other thing I want to clarify is I'm not here today to advocate for any particular change to the system. I'm really here to talk with you about things that we see from our perspective at OAR with working with people in the jail. We're up there four afternoons a week. We do the assigned counsel intakes for folks. And so there's some information that we've been able to glean that you may not have from any other place. One of the pieces of information I've shared with you all is the first 6 months of 2015, the bail intakes we conducted and the bails that we actually posted. And it gives you the amount of bails, the court, the charge, I believe is what's on that. What's really more interesting is what's not on that sheet. Because OAR has always had a bail limit that we imposed, our board of directors imposed. It was $2,500 most recently. But almost two years ago, the state legislature passed legislation allowing charitable bail organizations to function. We didn't know we weren't allowed to previously. We've been here for 30 years. But there was a judge in New York City who said that we fell under the insurance law. So there was a piece of legislation passed that changed the way we do operations somewhat in two fundamental ways. One is it lowered the amount we can bail to $2,000. We've interpreted that law to mean that we can still bail to $2,500 if the defendant, if the person accused, has a $500 copay. But that frequently doesn't happen anyway. And the other thing is we're not allowed to bail on felonies any longer. We rarely bailed on felonies anyway, but there were an occasional felony that we would do a bail on. The law actually is written, it's very poorly written actually, but it's written so that we're only allowed to bail on misdemeanors. We continue to bail on violations. Part of the problem is the law was passed by the New York State Legislature, heavily dominated by New York City legislators in committee. And so the justice system functions very differently in New York City than it does in upstate New York. So that in New York City, people charged with violations are not, bail's not set at all most frequently. They're just ROR'd. And so I don't think they even thought about it. But we're continuing to bail on violations. Again, reading the law to mean if you can bail on a misdemeanor because there's an omission, you should be able to bail on anything lesser. But we're taking a little bit of liberty, and we are talking with the legislators in Albany. But the facts that aren't on this sheet that I think are somewhat interesting are things like, and these are just anecdotal, in July of this year, there was a $10,000 bail set in Lansing Court on a petty larceny charge. Well, we don't do an intake or a bail on that because that's above our limit. A $4,000 bail was set in Dryden for unauthorized use of a vehicle. And in September, a $75,000 bail was set in Dryden on a burglary second charge. So I think what I'm here to say today is that I realize that some courts are sick of seeing the same people over and over again. And we're tired of seeing them in our offices, too. I also realize that many of our rural townships, particularly, justices are seeing second and third generations of the same families. However, the purpose of bail is to assure that pretrial defendants return to court. It's not to punish an individual and his or her family pretrial, nor is it to force the repayment of court-imposed fines. OAR has had bails forfeited to pay court fines in the past, and is also not preventive detention. Simply put, money bail discriminates against the poor. And I will say that we've seen more RORs, release on our own recognizance, being implemented in many of our courts since the advantage of counsel at first appearance has been implemented in this county. And that's incredibly heartening, I think a great step forward for justice. Excessive bail, which is more prevalent in our town and village courts, discriminates even more against the poor. The majority of inmates in the Tompkins County Jail have not been convicted of a crime. They are awaiting trial, and those who await trial in jail are more likely to be sentenced to incarceration at the conclusion of the case than those who remain free during their trial, pending trial. Putting individuals in our jail for failure to pay fines is just occurring too often. Many of these individuals are indigent and homeless, and incarcerating them for failure to repay fines with money they don't have is a poor approach to justice. It hardly allows them to earn the money to pay the fine. It costs the taxpayer close to $100 in a day. And in effect, it penalizes the individual twice for the same offense, the crime that's outstanding and being reincarcerated for nonpayment. I think someone who's testified here previously referred to it as the reemergence of debtor prisons. So to just close, I mean, while I believe that a number of the approaches discussed previously at these meetings could streamline and improve aspects of our criminal justice system and ultimately reduce costs, coordinating scheduling of town courts, central booking and arraignment, these improvements will not change the fact that justice varies greatly among the courts in Tompkins County. Our system of local courts with lay judges is rooted in a long-held belief that justice closer to the people is better justice. I think it's also rooted in the belief that many of us hold but don't acknowledge, that if you're arrested for a crime, you're probably guilty. As children, we're taught that justice is blind. Nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, in a small town where everyone knows everyone else, or at least their cousin, assumptions are made about individuals and families that are perpetuated for years, often in spite of the truth of the matter. At the very least, each of us deserves justice dispensed by someone who knows and respects the law. I urge this task force to look at a wide range of solutions to the reality of unequal justice within our community. And there was a Martin Luther King quote that I put at the top of my statement that really speaks to me. It's just, justice denied anywhere diminishes justice everywhere. And to me, that's what we're looking at in our current system.
Thank you, Deb. Before we take questions, why don't we hear from Dr. Brown, and then we'll open up so Dr. Brown,
yeah,
please.
Sure. Thank you, Mrs. Lauder and other members of the committee for this wonderful invitation. I must admit, I'm rarely in front of audiences where I know so little about the topic I'm being asked to reflect on. And with that in mind, as the Boy Scout in me, I wanted to be prepared. So I've spent the last week with a lot of folks I know and work with asking questions about their involvement with courts. I have a twin brother who's a magistrate in Virginia, and that conversation ended pretty quickly. He said, "I'm in the Commonwealth of Virginia, you're in New York State." End of conversation. So from there, I moved on to conversations with teachers, principals, executive team members, and board members even. And I'm here to report back, like myself, most folks knew very little about what happened, and they all spoke to the lack of collaboration, the lack of information flow between the two organizations, the need to collaborate, the need for the schools to be involved in some pre-intervention services of sorts. And I've been on the end of that also. I mean, there have been situations where we know of a young person who's involved with the court system, but we are unable to get any information about what's happening. We learn from parents who have kids in that young person's class, who've heard about something, or other folks, anonymous phone calls, emails to me, anonymous emails to me, speaking to young people who are involved in the court systems, with some pretty egregious charges, perceived charges, yet we know very little about what's happening. And that has caused some concerns on our end also. And again, from each person I spoke with, they all spoke to the community. We are in a tough spot. I feel, having been here 5 years now, that I serve a community that wishes for as little police presence or court presence in our schools as possible. I've attempted to provide an SRO for our high school, and that's been denied each time we even bring the conversation up. We've talked about potential collaborations with the courts, even a field trip or a visit to talk about, to be inside of beautiful spaces, and our parents and our community have spoken about not wanting that. So I'm saying to you, as the instructional leader of the school district, we would love to create partnerships, be a part of the system in positive ways, preventive ways, but I also know that I represent a community that doesn't feel comfortable yet engaging in that type of a conversation or having that kind of a presence. And quite frankly, the local media and the most recent media stories aren't helping with that. But I'm here hoping that we can talk about what's possible, and I will do everything in my power to be in a situation the next time I'm asked to speak on a topic like this topic, I will have some more information and be able to speak to some things that are happening versus walking around and talking to staff and still getting that blank stare.
Fair enough. Thank you, Dr. Braun. All right, why don't we open this up? I know that each of us probably has different questions of each of you, so do you want to start with you, Gwen? Go ahead.
Thank you both for sharing your time with us this evening. I have my first question, I guess, for Deb, because she talked first, and I'll forget the question if I don't know. Could you clarify, you were speaking about centralization, not being a solution to the problem of uneven justice. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't believe that just having a central booking place and central arraignment is going to solve the issue of... I haven't been privy to your conversations about who would be presiding over that central process.
You haven't been privy
to conversations about who would be presiding.
No, I don't think there've been.
You know, so that's really part of what I'm talking about is what is the degree of knowledge and education of the law of the person who's presiding, and whether it's central or decentralized, it really is the preparation of a justice to serve the law.
Okay. All right. My next question is for Dr. Braun. How can we help? How can we start to forge a connection? I know that I have been personally involved with some criminal justice issues that have impacted students at the high school, when Mr. Powers was there, and I was involved in what were some very, very uncomfortable meetings, and my sense was that there was a great chasm of mistrust and just bad feeling. We need to get some credibility. So my office, the court system, the police, would all, I think I'd be speaking for all of us when I say we'd give a great deal to be able to open up a conversation and get some people at the table.
Yeah.
Do you have anything you can suggest?
Yes, and we've started with the Ithaca Police Department already. It's you and I sitting down and us having the conversation initially and bring in other folks to build that relationship and trust, talk about our different perspectives, the systems that are in place and what are not in place. The conversation just hasn't happened. And now we have people in leadership positions who want it to happen and who are looking to trust instead of putting up barriers, on our end for sure.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. So if I call you up, we can have a conversation.
We're going to touch base before I leave, I hope.
All right.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. That's all I've got, right? Thank you.
Fair enough. Liz?
I, too, know very little about the court system. I'm the town supervisor and have a separation there, but so I've been mostly listening to people. But at our last meeting, one of the people from the sheriff's department said, you know, it would be really helpful if we didn't have five courts all meeting on Monday night. So I guess my question would be to you, Deb, is there anything we can do? I mean, I went back to our justices and, you know, brought that message back, and they said, well, you know, we can change to another night. So are there any things that we could do in the rural courts that would help without, you know, consolidation or anything like that?
I think some of those issues, I didn't mean to diminish those improvements. I think that they would help. They would certainly help expense-wise, where you have assigned counsels running to five different courts, where you have sheriff's deputies, you know, driving, you know, correctional people from the jail to court. I think that scheduling is huge, and I think that's a discussion that's wonderful that you as a supervisor took back to your justices. And I think, you know, I overheard Betty talking about a meeting of the magistrates this weekend where that would be discussed. And I think that kind of scheduling thing could certainly improve operations. And save some money operationally. What I was saying was I'm not sure it's going to improve the quality of justice.
Okay. Betty?
This is for you, Debbie. Define quality of justice.
Well, when I have to tell a client who comes in that they were really stupid to steal a toothbrush in Dryden because they're going to face a year in county jail, possibly. That if they're going to steal a toothbrush, they should steal it in the city of Ithaca. That tells me that punishment is different and bail is different and sometimes even charges are different depending on where you're arraigned. So the quality of justice in my mind is, if I commit a crime or am accused of committing a crime, I should pretty much be able to expect the same general range of bail on that crime, regardless of where I committed that crime. So that's one piece of the quality of justice. I'm not an attorney. You know, I've observed attorneys. I think that, you know, there are good attorneys and there are better attorneys, and there are a handful of not so good attorneys. So I don't think it's limited, you know, just to judges. I'm just saying that the quality of justice is impacted by a whole series of things, the quality of your defense, you know, but bail is kind of where your entry point is. And whether you're ROR'd or if a, you know, if a $10,000 bail is set on a petty larceny charge, that's going to have an impact on how your case resolves itself.
Now, I too agree. Certainly, I don't know the background on this particular $10,000 bail. I, quite frankly, was taken aback a bit when you gave me that these statistics here, you know, for the charges. We are, as judges, when we do an arraignment, we are responsible for letting the defendant know what the possible punishments are for whatever crime it is that they are alleged to have committed. And notice I said alleged. Okay. Most misdemeanors are up to a year in jail.
Right.
Now, I think if you go downstate, you can get a different type of justice. So it's not unique to Tompkins County, per se. It's not unique to Tompkins County. So that's why I wanted your definition of...
And in fact, I would say that in many respects, Tompkins County in this as well is better than other rural upstate counties. But it's never stopped Tompkins from saying we can do it better. You know, we are... So I think it's more... We do a better job than many of our neighboring or contiguous counties, but we don't usually just accept doing it decently. We try to improve in this county. And so I think that's what I was trying to say, is that definitely there's a difference between upstate and downstate.
Okay. And one more
Please.
Question.
Yep.
This is for Dr. Brown. You had mentioned that the schools are not aware of, you know, for instance, if a young individual is in trouble and the schools are not aware that he or she has had a run-in with, the law, or they're in the process of going to court. You do realize that the courts, with them being youthful offenders, the courts are not able to divulge that information because they are youthful offenders. So we are, with the exception of felonies, but we are placed under restrictions as well as far as the statute goes with regard to that. Certainly, I would love to be able to sit down and discuss with you as well. Maybe some possible solutions to this and get the schools more involved, I think.
As long as we're on that topic, why don't I can clarify. It didn't occur to me, but Judge Poole is very wise to bring it up. Youthful offenders are offenders who are over 16 but under 19. They are required by law to be treated in a separate proceeding if they're even eligible, if they're even possibly eligible to be treated as youthful offenders or to receive youthful offender treatment. Now, youthful offender treatment
is a way that a young defendant can be adjudicated and not have a criminal conviction. The youthful offender adjudication substitutes for the conviction, and so that later in their life they can say, I've not been convicted of a crime. It's a good thing. It's maybe not the best we can do, but it's a good thing. However, what also goes with that is a high level of confidentiality. And Judge Poole's right. The school can't call up the court and say, Judge, would you share with us the alleged facts surrounding the incident of young Mr. or Ms. So-and-so? They can't. It's against the law. And even for felonies, doesn't matter. Juvenile offenders who are under the age of 15 and under, are subject to proceedings in family court, and again, the confidentiality rules that govern those files are very, very strict. So I just wanted to piggyback on Judge Poole's comments because I didn't. She thought to bring it up, and I didn't.
Well, you're much more articulate, so thank you.
And thanks for the clarification. I believe that I understood that and understand it as well, but I'm hoping you're understanding the issues that creates, and how we navigate that is what I'm hoping that we can collaborate on.
Absolutely.
How to help young people.
Right, because it seems to me that there's more than just particular individuals that raise the concern. You mentioned, for instance, the idea of just going and visiting a court. I know that Judge Peacock was talking about doing that. Mm-hmm. As a city court judge, as a regular thing, would bring in the middle school students and introduce them and show them the court and hopefully never see them again in the court. And so those kinds of things that are more positive and yet informative collaborations might actually help. It also raises, and I'll direct this question as a follow-up to you, Dr. Brown, and I know this is somewhat tangential to our charge, but the whole notion of these youth courts as a way of avoiding any stigma of criminal prosecution. And the question is, if we were to ever go with something like that, would the school district actually be amenable to being the venue for that type of thing? Or would it make sense if we were to do that, to do it independent of any school district? I mean, those kinds of things. Are you familiar
with
all this?
Yes, and we would want to be involved with that process. I think the restorative nature of it would be right in line with our mission and vision. So, yes, we would want to be a part of that conversation.
Right. Mm-hmm. We're given some information, and we're going to review it and what have you, but that would be,
awesome.
Part of this conversation. Mm-hmm. I have some specific questions that I'd kind of like to ask just to get some data in the record, and primarily for you, Deb. Does the OIR have a limit of the amount of money that it can use for bail in any given year or at any given time?
The only limit really is what we have in our fund, okay? And we have a line of credit. for $10,000 at the alternatives. Every few years, I have to come to the legislature and request an appropriation to replenish that bail fund. It's not because of forfeitures so much. Our forfeiture rate's really quite low, but it's because they may take so long being returned because the cases last so long. And so if we have a real rush on, or if we do a handful of $22,000 bails, it doesn't take long to diminish that account. So right now our balance is at $600 and some. Our first response to a low balance like that is I get my staff to do exoneration orders to all the judges to make sure that anything that's due back comes back, and we usually get a little flurry, and it helps replenish it. But I am... I haven't even talked to Joe about it, but I probably will have to come to the legislature for an appropriation for the bail fund.
And so what is, if you added up all of the bail that is posted currently, what would that number be?
I think we've got approximately $62,000 in circulation.
Okay.
And the appropriation we generally get from the county, I think it's $15,000 that I request as needed. And that's been, I don't think I've been to the legislature now in 2.5 years. For the bail fund, maybe
and
two.
Of that $62,000, you said your default rate is low. Can you quantify that?
Yeah, since I've been there 9 years now, almost, 10% default was the largest percentage of, so, and usually it runs about 4% of the total bails that have been posted. So it's really, part of that's because we do get some leniency from judges. We beg for them to let us try to round up our client and find them. Part of that's also, I have to give my staff credit because as a part of bail, we request that people stay in touch with us weekly. That happens generally. It doesn't happen all the time. So some of the staff's time is calling disconnected cell phones. I know I've spent some time myself driving around to known places of the homeless or going down to the jungle to say, don't forget, tomorrow morning you have a city court appointment. So it's not just posting the bail and walking away. We try to develop a relationship with that individual so that we can maintain it afterward.
And what is the difference between a bail that you post and a bail loan?
Okay.
I mean, they both have to get paid back.
They all have to get paid back. We've never gone to court to collect on the handful of defaults we've had.
On the loans?
On the loans.
I see. So,
in effect, we make people sign when they get a bail that we can come after them or their co-signer. For a defaulted bail, we explain it to them very clearly. But the fact of the matter is that the people that I can talk about that have defaulted, there's no money there. There's no money from the person who co-signed to collect.
And with respect to fines and the debtor-prison issue, are you folks permitted to loan money for fines?
I don't know if we're permitted. We don't. Let me put it that way.
Is that something that has been considered?
Yes, at times it has been. Generally, what we've done is post the $630 bail or the $125 bail. The odd bails are usually bails that are set for fines. It's the amount of the fine. And hope that we get it back.
So you indicated that there is, forgive me, but I want to get this information. You indicated that right now your limit is either $2,000 or $2,500. Is that something that is well known to all of the local courts?
Yes, because what has happened in the past is our bail, when I first got here, I think our bail limit was $1,500. So there were consistently certain courts where the bail was posted at $2,000.
It was set at $2,000 by
the
court.
Set rather.
And your impression was that was done intentionally
by certain courts, not across the board.
And so my question is, and are you able, if we wanted to dig deeper into this, would you be able to identify the courts where that was happening?
Yeah, I'm not prepared to do that tonight, but I can tell you that since the law was passed and our bail is $2,000 or $2,500, that we're seeing more $3,000 bails being set. In the past, the $3,000 bail was a clear note to us that it was a drug court issue coming out of the city. And so we just said, okay, there's more we have to look at here. We have to talk to the attorneys, the probation. We have to talk to some people. And we didn't post generally on the drug court bails. Now we're seeing that $3,000 in other courts other than drug court.
So in other words, it didn't matter whether the judge was a lay judge or a lawyer-trained judge. There was the use of bail for other than coming to court purposes across the board, whether it's drug court reasons or
yes.
whether it's we want to keep them in jail because they're from New York City reasons.
Yes.
Deb, can I clarify, I think, what your answer was, but you were trying to explain the drug court,
okay.
how it works.
Sure. Yes.
When defendants enter Ithaca City Treatment Court, one of the sanctions that a defendant agrees to is if there is a jail sanction after graduated sanctions, they understand that the bail will be set at $3,000, $6,000, and they're not going to bail themselves out. That's part of the sanction. So it's that's the Ithaca City Treatment Court's bail across the board that it's set for a sanction. The person isn't resentenced, it's a sanction. So that's how it's...
Okay, I got it.
It has nothing to do with
so it's
trying
a contract.
To get around...
Right.
OAR, and I think you were trying to say that you were aware that was a part of
okay.
the drug court.
It's trying, to avoid bail.
Yeah, but it's for purposes of basically a short-term sentence as opposed to reappearance.
It's
guaranteed
it's for a purpose, not well counted under the statute.
All right.
It is under the drug court.
Under the drug
yes.
court rubric.
Yes.
All right, fair enough. Gwen.
I was just going to note that there had been discussion in the treatment court team about whether bail should be set on those, but in order for the person, the participant, to get credit for the time, bail has to be set up, so bail is set up.
Right.
The vast majority of the jail sanctions are between usually 2 or 3 days. I think the longest one I know about was 5 days. I don't know if Judge Nader would have other experience, but we're in misdemeanor treatment
no.
court. The longest jail sanction I've heard of is 5 days. The most common one is about a little shy of 3 days. With
oh.
bail set.
I just have 2 other questions, Deb. One is there some way to determine court by court the bail that has been requested for, say, a particular offense? Let's just arbitrarily say petty larceny. Could we look at all of the petty larcenies and then find out, you know, this court, the average bail was X dollars, and in that court it was Y dollars?
Yeah, I tried to do that today, actually, and realized that our booking forms that we get from the Sheriff's Department that recaps the bookings, doesn't show us the jurisdiction. But I know they are available because I have seen them and have done some research in there. So, yes, they are available from the Sheriff's Department. And the other way I got some of the data I gave you today was off of our assigned counsel intakes, because we do assign counsel for almost everyone, and so we can get the jurisdiction, the bail, and the charge. But I know that there are reports generated, and we've gotten them in the past. I just didn't have them, where it shows exactly what you're looking for.
Okay. Joe, did you have something to add?
Yeah, we have kind of the mega data from the jail. And we can generate that kind of information, and I'll bring it to the task force. One thing that we have to watch out for is it's keyed on highest charge. So it could be that you see petty larceny in one place and bail is $10,000, in another place it's $1,000. But then when you dive deep, you find that there's a lot of other charges that went with petty larceny. It was simply the highest charge there. So I can generate some statistics for you, and we can dive as deep as you'd like to in those to get a sense of bail levels by court and by judge.
Okay, and then I just have one final question. Process-wise, how does this work? And in other words, if I am accused of petty larceny and I am in Judge Poole's court, and she sets bail, and I don't have the money. Is there a way by which the individual can contact OAR immediately and have the bail posted without going to the jail, or am I going to be stuck in jail for a few days while that works itself out?
You're going to be stuck in jail, but the longest is if that happens on a Friday night, and we get the they fax us who's been booked into the jail, and we're there on Monday morning. But there's a process there too, because we go through the bail intake, we talk to the person about the responsibilities, and try to get a cosigner if the bail's substantial. But bails are kind of our first priority, but we don't work in the evenings, and we don't work on the weekends. Now, there are some exceptions. When, like, Grassroots is happening, I give my number to Judge Dresser. There are times when we know that there may be a flood of people in on really bailable charges.
And do they, let's say it's a Tuesday or a Monday, will you be there the next morning?
Tuesdays we won't be, it's visiting day, so we're there Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Fridays.
So all of these Monday courts, those folks aren't going to possibly get out until Wednesday.
Well, what we've started doing is the jail's been really helpful the last couple of years with us, is doing a video conferencing for the intakes, so that we can do a video conference if there are people in there with $100, $250, $500 bails. Frequently we'll get a call from Captain Bunce, and we'll do an intake over the phone and then drive up on a Tuesday to post a bail, because there's also so much boarding out going on that we try to assist the jail with that to avoid.
Just a follow up on that, if we had some kind of an electronic system so that when Judge Poole set the bail at $300 and I didn't have $300, that would then become part of an electronic system that would immediately become accessible to OAR. Can you envision your systems being set up such that you could immediately respond to that evening and perhaps electronically post the bail?
I think it could be done. I think we don't have the technological capacity right now. We have QuickBooks instead of Excel and ledgers. I mean, we've made great strides, but I think we have a PayPal button on our webpage, but we don't have great technological capacity. But if it is set up by someone else where we could tap into it and see what the bails were, I can see in this day and age why things could be done. We could have a separate debit card linked to our bail fund. Mm-hmm. And be able to process them fairly quickly. I don't want to promise immediate 7 days a week, because I've a very small staff.
But the whole point could be that if the county were willing to fund such a thing, it would be saving itself the $100 a day in jail costs.
Yeah.
All right, fair enough. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mark.
Just want to thank both of you.
Glenn?
Yeah, I want to make sure I understand particularly your data, Deb. On the first page where it has bail intakes, so those are bail intakes for defendants who have been whose bail has been set at $2,500 or less during the first 6 months of 2015?
Yes.
Okay. And you may have interviewed other people, but their bails were set at some figure higher. And right. They're not included in this data.
They're not included in this because we probably met with them to do assigned counsel forms, to talk to them about bail, to let them know some options.
Okay.
But they're not part of our official bail intake.
Okay. So in the first 6 months, it looks like you did 31, I think I counted 31 intakes. Okay. And the second chart, which has about 29 or 27 people, are the bail loans. Am I correct in understanding these are the ones where the defendant defaulted?
No, those are the ones where we actually posted a bail.
Okay, but are these bail loan folks some of the same folks from the bail intake?
Yes.
Because I tried to match some up and I couldn't get any matches. But I only just glanced at it just briefly.
I had staff kind of pull it together, okay. So I'll ask that question and clarify, but they should match up some. On the other hand, she might have just pulled the bail intakes that we didn't bail and then showed you the ones that we did bail.
Okay.
In which case, this is an all-inclusive.
How much investigation do you normally do? So if I have somebody in and I set their bail at $1,000 on a Monday night, or, yeah, a Monday night, and you get it the next day or 2 days later, what do you do in addition to whatever I've done or not done that night when I did the set the bail?
Well, we do a couple things. We look at what the charges, who the defendant is, you know, if they're in jail or not. We look at whether they've defaulted on a bail loan in the past for OAR, because if they've defaulted in the past...
it's a bad sign.
Yeah. It doesn't automatically preclude them. But it certainly makes us hesitate a little bit more. We also, quite honestly, depending on where our bail fund balance is, if someone's coming up in a day or so to court and our balance is really low, we might wait to see if the bail gets reduced at the court date that's set a day or so after we get the paper. It's not ideal, but we might do that because of not having the money. And then we either do it video conferencing if it's a Tuesday, or we do it in person. The other days we go and we interview the client. We talk to them about what happened around the incident. We get their recount of the incident, and we weigh some of those, not that, but the amount of bail, their ties to the community, how likely they are to show up, the amount of bail, and bail for them. More frequently than not, the place where there's biggest reservation and the most investigation is if there's a criminal contempt charge, which then we have to dig deeper and find out if there was a violation of an order of protection, and we will talk to the Advocacy Center and others about that. And we have bailed on occasion on criminal contempt charges, but it's after a lot more research and talking to a lot of people.
Okay. Do you have any way of developing data that would show, based on your review of actual defendants, how many people have had their bail set too high for you to actually help them by bailing them out, when those same people are highly likely to reappear in court? Do you understand my question?
I understand your question. I think that data is available through the data that Joe was referring to, because you could just generate what the bails are. And
yeah, but that would tell you what the bail is, but it doesn't tell you necessarily that OAR is investigated and come to the conclusion, no, this person will show up or has in the past.
I could probably generate something. It wouldn't be hugely, it would be tedious. It's going through our intakes, but we could certainly tell you, we do most of the bails that we can, and we have a low default rate on that. So our assumption is generally, even if someone is from out of town, our assumption is once we've met with them and talked with them, they're going to show up in court.
Could I just ask clarification on that, because I want to make sure I understand the question. Are you asking, Glenn, that if, in other words, a local court reviews the situation, sets the bail at, say, $3,500, in part because the local court says this person has recidivated, this person has not shown up in the past, and we know it, and candidly, we don't want him posting bail unless it's his money or her money?
I guess I'm looking for the situation where a court is sort of deliberately going above OAR's limit, knowing that that person will not be able to use OAR, when in fact OAR investigates and says, no, this person will show up. There's no reason why this bail should be at $3,500. It should be either below $2,500 or it should be ROR. Okay. Because in essence, every time OAR pays the bail, they are, in essence, saying to the judge, you should have ROR'd this person, because, in effect, we are ROR'ing them because we're using our money, the county money, to bail them out. There's no reason why they should have had the bail set. Now, that being said, there are times where in the middle of the night, I'll have a case. I know very little information about this person. I might have a criminal record that shows they didn't appear four or five times. My immediate reaction is, well, what makes me think they're going to show up now? They have no ties to the community. They live in Indiana. They're driving through, whatever. And frankly, it's not so much the nature of the charge that really determines the bail. It's the likelihood of reappearance.
Right.
So I will often, in that kind of situation, set the bail at a figure within OAR's limit for the express purpose that you will investigate more carefully than I can possibly investigate at 3 o'clock in the morning. And if you find that the person should be released, in essence what happens, you bail them out. The next time they appear in court, if they have an attorney with an ounce of sense in their head, they'll ask for the bail to be dropped to ROR, and I generally go along with it because, well, they showed up this time. Why not?
Yeah, but Glenn, can I interject here? Do you have access to their criminal records?
No.
See, now no. That's an issue too, because if...
Do you not ever have access to the criminal records?
No.
No, they never do.
No, yeah, we never do.
And that's key.
Well, I agree. That's sort of why I asked the question about what investigation do you
Well,
do?
We don't have access to the previous, any criminal history, except I don't know why we don't, but we do... With a certain group of our clients, we have extensive knowledge of their history because we've worked with them very closely over a period of time, and that's really actually a substantial subset of the jail population.
May I ask a question? Since I hadn't thought of it. How long has OAR been doing assigned counsel applications in the jail?
Well, I know we've been doing it since I came 9 years ago.
Sure.
I can't speak to prior to that.
And that's an enormous saving for the county.
Yeah.
He said looking at the county. Yes.
They've been very generous to us.
Because otherwise, those are folks whose relatives are going to have to call the assigned counsel office and or wait until bail has been set and they're out so that they can make the application. Does the county give you any compensation for that time?
Yes. When Joe came on, what we did when I came 9 years ago was try to quantify the value of OAR services, and it was easiest to quantify vis-a-vis the bails. But in addition to that, we've exchanged information about what it would cost the county for a county employee to have to do all those assigned counsel intakes and follow up. And so, yes, I would say that could it always be more? Yes. But we do, we've been fairly treated.
But one more question, I think it's an easy one. Could you, from the data that you have going back, how many years of data do you have?
At the most, 9.
Okay. That's funny.
Everything was shredded when I got there.
Could you go back a couple of years, 3 years, and pull for us the forfeiture patterns and, of course, then run those forfeitures with specific reference to those that were forfeit in relation to an unpaid fine?
I'm not positive I have that data about why it was forfeited. But I will see what we've got because we do bail reports for the county that shows.
In that context, when a court seeks to forfeit bail in payment of a fine that is not paid, does OAR have representation in that proceeding? I mean, they just don't know.
No, though I, in the past, have contacted the county comptroller and the county attorney, one or the other.
Would they appear?
No, but they would send a letter, and we would get the money returned sometimes. Because I would write a letter to the judge just saying it's that this is a misuse of bail.
Well, in fact, a court cannot use bail to pay a fine if it's not, particularly if it's not the defendant's money.
Exactly.
It has to be the party who signed the bail form, right?
Right.
So if a court took that money to pay the fine, I think it would be beyond its jurisdiction to do that.
Yeah.
That's what we've argued. We've argued that it's a theft of county funds from the county coffers to townships.
Has it actually happened, though?
Yes.
It has?
Yes.
But the court...
That'll get rid of town and village justices real quick if there's a theft of county funds.
No, but the court can forfeit the bail for non-appearance.
Right.
Yes.
And that may be the rubric that is followed.
Yes, because we have to require, even if it's a person who posted the bail for the defendant, say, girlfriend, we require them to bring in the bail receipt and on the back indicate bail to be used for fine and then their signature in our presence.
Yeah, they have to agree to it.
Yes.
They don't agree to it.
Yes, they cannot just arbitrate. If it says OAR on the bail receipt, I would like to.
It's happened three times that I can recall, and I think that we've managed to recoup the money with the letter, the first letter I sent, and then in another case, the county attorney sent a letter.
So it's one thing if it's just sloppiness; it's another thing if it's done deliberately.
And I don't know.
Glenn, do you have another? Yeah, go ahead.
I think I did have one. You mentioned, I think you said that there were times when people were being put in jail for failure to pay a fine when in fact they had the ability to pay a fine, or did not have the ability to pay the fine. They were indigent. Is that anecdotal, or do you have data on that?
It's fairly anecdotal. I could probably, looking through this list, well, here's one, third from the bottom of the bail intakes. Was a failure to pay restitution of $630. I can tell you, Justice, that the majority of our clients are indigent.
Oh, right.
So that, you know, I mean, most everyone we do assign counsel intakes for qualifies. If they don't qualify, they're generally not in the jail. They've generally posted the bail and they're out.
But in that situation, isn't there a mechanism for the attorney to ask for relief from the fine given the inability to pay?
I believe there is.
So is that pursued or is that suggested as opposed to just writing a check for $630?
We don't pursue it.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sometimes a risk is had in the form of a violation of probation for failure to pay restitution, or a risk is had in the form of a violation. Restitution. It's a term and condition of conditional discharge. In those circumstances, the defense counsel can seek resentencing, and that can be jail. But the judges, to my knowledge, don't put people in jail because they can't afford to pay. They may work out a payment plan that takes forever, as we did with the Stop DWI fine collection. Not a single person went to jail who couldn't afford to pay. But when it comes up as a resentencing, then it's not a debtor's prison because they don't go to jail for the debt, they go to jail. It's kind of a silly distinction, but...
But I think if we're playing this carefully, I believe that if the sole reason for, upon resentence, if the sole reason for putting the person in jail is because the person cannot pay the fine or cannot pay the restitution, I don't believe that's constitutionally permissible.
Well, we have to see if that is what has happened. I don't know what that $630 is, but that may be the case.
So what would the
If the court has already determined that the appropriate punishment is not jail, but is say a fine, and then the amount of the fine must be driven by, or strike that. The court can impose whatever fine it wants, but it cannot then put the person in jail because the person doesn't pay the fine.
Right,
because if the reason for not paying is simply inability.
Right, but restitution turns on a different principle, I think. I don't think you should put people in jail just because they can't pay. I think that's
what
not
do you
a
do?
Judgment. And that's
that's a debtor's prison. That's the definition of a debtor's prison.
They sign a confession of judgment, it just allows the creditor to...
Oh, the confession of judgment is...
Yeah.
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 I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
What judgment will be provided under the confession of judgment? That the amount owed?
Yeah, the amount.
And nothing more?
Right. Nothing more.
Right.
As far as I know, nothing more.
Yeah.
I think that's the appropriate remedy. But Scott has been remarkably silent. I want to give him a chance to ask questions. So go ahead, Judge Miller.
We have a system in the city court. All fines and surcharges after a due date all get converted to judgments. We don't have a debtor's prison in city court. There's a procedure that we follow in city court under the CPL. And fines and surcharges, even restitution, can become judgments, so that procedure's laid out. I just don't have it off the top of my head of what the section is. I have three questions. I have two questions for Deb, and I have one question for Dr. Brown. Ms. Dietrich, judges have the authority. They can forfeit a bail that has been posted. Are you saved by a phone call?
Phones never save me. They just aggravate.
It might be someone you have to post some bail for. I don't want...
That's okay. Keep going,
it's after
Judge.
Hours.
Forgive me.
If a defendant misses a court appearance, a judge can, on the spot, at the conclusion of the court appearance, order that the bail be forfeited. Do you have the data for all the town and village courts and the county courts and the city courts? Although a judge can, at that court appearance that is missed, order the bail be forfeited, the judge has the additional remedy of ordering that the bail be forfeited subject to a forfeiture order that is stayed for 30 days. The judge has discretion. The judge can also order bail be forfeited and then permit a certain amount of time for an application by the party who has posted the bail that the bail not be forfeited. Do you have any data on are the town, village, city, county courts ordering OAR's bail to be forfeited for missed court appearances? And I haven't really wrapped my head around whether OAR should be given special treatment or not.
That's a separate issue.
That's a separate issue, but I'm just curious. Is it being done across the board?
I don't have data on that. We have such a low forfeiture rate that what I can say is that I think that the judges and justices have been indulgent towards us when we call them and say, please give us some time to round this person up. So that I don't think that the forfeiture is a common occurrence.
Okay.
I mean, with a 4% forfeiture rate, we're not talking a lot. So I don't have data on
all
that.
Right. And the second question I have, a big issue that we're talking over, and it occurred to me the following. I have many defendants come in front of me at after hours with an attorney, and it is clear from the defendant's criminal history or lack thereof. And sometimes the defendant's extensive criminal history is quite telling. If I've got 67 misdemeanor convictions and no failed court appearances, I've got a real good record that they're going to appear. This person goes every week getting arrested and shows up all the time. Couldn't be better.
Right.
Not a flight risk. Crime risk, maybe, but not a flight risk. But when they're in front of me, they're so intoxicated. They're so under the influence of a mind-altering substance. I've got someone at 10 o'clock at night on a Sunday night or a Saturday night, and I know if this person wasn't intoxicated, wasn't under the influence of a narcotic, this person would be ROR'd. But right now, even with an attorney present, this person at this moment is a flight risk. I have no confidence that this person can comprehend what's going on to the extent that the person understands that they need to come to court again. So bail will be set because the person right now is a flight risk. But I know that in 24 hours or 12 hours, this person is going to be in a much different state. So we will at city court, but we have the benefit of being able to do this with 5 days a week, Monday through Friday. If it's a Saturday or Sunday, we'll have that person come back Monday at 10 a.m.
Right.
Or if it's Monday night, we'll have that person come back Tuesday at 10 a.m. for a bail review. Does that happen in the town and village courts? When you're dealing with those people, that they're much different when you're seeing them. They're you know that they were highly intoxicated. They were much different. They presented much differently in front of the judge. Are they coming back in a day or two, or are they coming back in a week? What's going on?
Well, first of all, we see them highly intoxicated on a pretty frequent basis. You're talking about a core group of OAR clients of probably 25 people countywide. And if it's in the village and the town courts,